You were just listening to Sarah Nelson on Union Power. She spoke at the University of Oregon in Eugene in mid-November 2024. Sarah Nelson is the president of the Association of Flight Attendants Union and a longtime advocate for workers' rights and unions. This program is produced by Alternative Radio. We're an independent nonprofit in our 39th year. We're supported solely by individuals just like you. We feature such voices as Wendell Potter, Kuhan Pakmander, Ralph Nader, Peter Beinert, Chris Hedges, and Arundhati Roy. To access our complete audio and book catalog, just go to our website, alternativeradio.org. Again, our website where we are podcasting, alternativeradio.org. For copies of today's program, Sarah Nelson on Union Power, and for Howard Zinn's classic book, A People's History of the United States, just call us, 1-800-444-1977. That's 1-800-444-1977. Or online, our website, alternativeradio.org. That's alternativeradio.org. Printed transcripts, PDFs, and MP3s of this program are free of charge. Just call us, 1-800-444-1977. Matt Laubach recorded the program. Joe Ritchie is our general manager and editor. I'm David Barsamyan. Thank you for listening. We go out with Billy Bragg singing There's Power in a Union.
Totalitarianism, as I've called it, is perhaps nowhere more strikingly displayed than in the fact, on the one hand, totalitarian regimes mobilize populations, regiment them, generally control them in some kind of unanimous goose step. To put it very simply, totalitarianism seeks to mobilize populations. Inverted totalitarianism seeks to demobilize them.
That's Sheldon Wallen, and this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamyan. This edition of AR features Sheldon Wallen on inverted totalitarianism. Traditional totalitarianism conjures up images of jackbooted stormtroopers, gulags, and death camps. In recent years, a new variety of totalitarianism has emerged. Professor Sheldon Wallen calls it the inversion of totalitarianism. It represents the coming of age of corporate power and political demobilization of the citizenry. Unlike classical totalitarian systems, which openly boasted of their intentions to force their societies in a preconceived totality, inverted totalitarianism is not expressly conceptualized as an ideology, nor is it objectified in public policy. Corporations have de facto power and have, over the years, carried out a slow-motion coup d'etat. How to resist? Wallen says it starts at the local level. Our guest today is Sheldon Wallen. He was an award-winning scholar. Cornel West called him the greatest political theorist of and for democracy of our time. He taught at UC Berkeley and Princeton. He passed away in 2015. This classic from the AR archives was recorded in Willits, California in 2003. And now, Sheldon Wallen, Inverted Totalitarianism.
Let me first talk about the notion itself by suggesting what I'm sure some of you are at least familiar with, and that is general features of totalitarianism. That is, what are we looking
for? Before we get started, I'd like to remind you that the views, thoughts, and opinions expressed in this show are solely those of individuals involved and do not necessarily represent those of WRCT Pittsburgh and its...
From New York, this is Democracy Now!
What Trump is trying to do here is completely illegal. Congress passed a law that appropriated money. It set the policy for the government. Congress passed the law. The president signed it. A new president can't come along and say, I don't agree with the law, and so I'm unilaterally going to disregard it.
Will low-income families be able to keep the heat on? Will seniors have access to another meal on wheels? Or kids in need get breakfast or lunch? Will Medicaid continue? Will children still be able to go to Head Start? We'll speak with a former general counsel to the Office of Management and Budget about Trump's attempts to cut trillions from the federal budget. Then Mexican President Claudia Sheinbaum is set to join other Latin American and Caribbean heads of state for an emergency meeting to respond to Trump's mass deportations. We'll look at Sheinbaum's first 100 days and a response to Trump's renaming the Gulf of Mexico the Gulf of America.
The United Nations recognizes the name Gulf of Mexico, but next, why don't we call it Mexican America? It sounds nice, doesn't it?
We'll also look at how the Chinese startup DeepSeek has upended Silicon Valley. And hear from Ambassador Carolyn Kennedy, cousin of Robert F. Kennedy Jr. She just sent a letter and video to senators calling on them to reject his confirmation to head the Department of Health and Human Services. His confirmation hearing begins today. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. A federal judge in Washington, D.C. has temporarily halted President Trump's radical plan to freeze trillions of dollars in federal grants and loans, even though the money's already been appropriated by Congress. U.S. District Judge Lauren L. Alikhan said Tuesday she would decide by next week whether to make the injunction permanent. The ruling came after several nonprofits and attorneys general from 22 states filed lawsuits arguing the order would have a devastating impact on hundreds of thousands of recipients who rely on federal grants and loans for their operations. At the White House, President Trump's newly minted press secretary, Karoline Leavitt, defended Trump's unprecedented actions.
It means no more funding for illegal DEI programs. It means no more funding for the Green New Scam that has cost American taxpayers tens of billions of dollars. It means no more funding for transgenderism and wokeness across our federal bureaucracy and agencies.
As Trump's federal spending freeze briefly took effect Tuesday, Medicaid reimbursement portals went down in all 50 states, cutting off compensation to hospitals and clinics that provide health care to children, low-income families, and people with disabilities. Senate Democratic leader Chuck Schumer said Trump's actions would likely impact universities, nonprofits, food assistance programs, hospitals, and rural health centers, organizations that assist disabled veterans, and much more.
This decision is lawless. It's destructive, it's dangerous, it's cruel, it's illegal, and it's unconstitutional. Donald Trump has done a lot of bad things in the last week, but nothing's worse than this.
Washington Democratic Senator Patty Murray called Trump's executive order a brazen and illegal move. Maine Independent Senator Angus King said, quote, if this stands, Congress may as well adjourn, unquote. Vermont Independent Senator Bernie Sanders declared of Trump, he is not a king. We'll have more on this story after headlines. The White House has announced plans to offer all 2.3 million federal workers 8 months of salary and benefits in exchange for their resignation in a move condemned by labor unions as an unprecedented violation of laws governing buyout payments. A memo sent by the Office of Personnel Management to federal employees Tuesday urges anyone wishing to accept the deal to type the word resign into the body of an email replying to the offer. The American Federation of Government Employees, which represents more than 800,000 federal government in Washington, D.C. workers, said Trump's goal was to create chaos. Its national president, Everett Kelly, said, quote, between the flurry of anti-worker executive orders and policies, it's clear that the Trump administration's goal is to turn the federal government into a toxic environment where workers cannot stay even if they want to, unquote. President Trump Monday fired two leaders of the National Labor Relations Board in a major attack on workers' rights and labor unions. Trump's surprise removal of Democratic NLRB member Gwen Wilcox came even though federal law says board members can only be fired for neglect or malfeasance. Trump also ousted the NLRB general counsel Jennifer Abruzzo, who wrote in a parting statement, quote, if the agency does not fully effectuate its congressional mandate in the future, I expect workers with assistance from their advocates will take matters into their own hands in order to get well-deserved dignity and respect in the workplace, as well as a fair share of the significant value they add to their employer's operations, she said. White House Press Secretary Karoline Leavitt made her debut in the briefing room Tuesday, admitting to reporters the Trump administration believes all undocumented immigrants are criminals and will be targeted for mass detention and deportation. Raids are taking place nationwide, with thousands arrested since Trump's inauguration in cities like Chicago and New York City, where Homeland Security Secretary Kristi Noem joined ICE, that's Immigration and Customs Enforcement agents, in operations that began Tuesday, live tweeting the raids. ICE is reportedly planning a round of raids in Aurora, Colorado, Thursday, and three more cities are expected to be targeted next week. President Trump is signing the Lake and Riley Act into law today, his first piece of legislation since returning to office. The bill expands mandatory detention and possible deportation of undocumented people who are accused, though not convicted, of nonviolent theft crimes such as shoplifting. This comes as ICE has been directed to meet a quota of between 1,200 and 1,500 arrests per day as Trump plans to pack ICE detention centers, including those run by for-profit prison companies. In related news, Oklahoma's State Board of Education has unanimously approved a rule that'll force parents to provide proof of their children's citizenship and immigration status when they're enrolled in school. The policy still needs to be approved by Oklahoma's legislature and governor. Meanwhile, deportation flights from the U.S. to Colombia resumed Tuesday after a diplomatic spat over the abuse of asylum seekers who describe being shackled. This is Carlos Gomez, a deportee who arrived in Bogota on Tuesday.
The food they served was bad. Sometimes they gave awful burritos, terrible food, and we were locked up and sleeping for 10 or 12 hours because we had nothing else to do. We didn't even know if it was day or night. We were treated worse than prisoners.
The Senate has confirmed Sean Duffy as Secretary of Transportation on a vote of 77 to 22. Duffy's a former reality TV star, climate denier, and four-term Republican Congress member from Wisconsin who's worked as a lobbyist since resigning from Congress in 2019. As his first official act, Duffy moved to roll back the Biden administration's fuel efficiency standards for new cars and trucks. On Monday, senators voted 68 to 29 to confirm the billionaire hedge fund manager Scott Bessent as U.S. Treasury Secretary, with 16 Democrats supporting the nomination. In a statement, Public Citizen called Bessent an oligarch who spent a career serving rich clients, adding, quote, by ignoring climate change as a financial risk, Trump's Treasury Department under Bessent is on a path that could devastate hardworking families, they said. Senate confirmation hearings open today for President Trump's pick to lead the Department of Health and Human Services, Robert F. Kennedy Jr., and an environmental attorney known for spreading public health conspiracy theories and disinformation. He's claimed HIV may not cause AIDS, that COVID-19 was designed to spare Ashkenazi Jews and Chinese people, and that chemicals in the U.S. water supply are leading more children to be gay and transgender. Ahead of RFK Jr.'s appearance before the Senate Committee on Finance, his cousin, Carolyn Kennedy, the former U.S. ambassador to Japan and Australia, daughter of President John F. Kennedy, called on senators to reject RFK Jr.'s nomination.
I've known Bobby my whole life. We grew up together. It's no surprise that he keeps birds of prey as pets, because Bobby himself is a predator. Bobby is addicted to attention and power. Bobby preys on the desperation of parents of sick children, vaccinating his own kids while building a following, hypocritically discouraging other parents from vaccinating theirs.
We'll play more of Carolyn Kennedy's video to senators urging them not to confirm Robert Kennedy later in the broadcast. Kennedy's confirmation hearing follows President Trump's stop work order for all global health funding through the U.S. Agency for International Development, or USAID. On Monday, the Trump administration explicitly ordered foreign health organizations to stop administering drugs for HIV, malaria, and tuberculosis purchased with USAID, even if healthcare workers already have the medications on hand. On Tuesday, Secretary of State Marco Rubio issued a waiver for life-saving drugs under PEPFAR, the president's emergency plan for AIDS relief started by former President George W. Bush, which is credited with saving more than 25 million lives worldwide. But it's not clear whether Rubio's waiver will reverse Trump's freeze on funding for drugs for HIV/AIDS prevention, outreach and testing, and other programs. More than half a million people have returned to an unrecognizable northern Gaza in the past 72 hours, according to Palestinian authorities. People hoping to return home describe the utter decimation of North Gaza after 15 months of relentless Israeli bombings and attacks. In the occupied West Bank, Israeli forces killed at least two Palestinians in fresh raids that began overnight. One of the victims was identified as 25-year-old Osama Omar Abu Haija from Jenin. This comes as Israeli lawmakers have advanced a bill that would further facilitate the theft and purchase of land for illegal Israeli settlements in the West Bank. Israel's also continued its attacks on southern Lebanon, where at least five people were injured earlier today and another 24 wounded on Tuesday in Israeli airstrikes. Senate Democrats have blocked a bill that would sanction the International Criminal Court over its arrest warrants against Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and former Defense Minister Yoav Gallant for possible war crimes in Gaza. UN experts and others have warned the legislation would set a dangerous precedent for the erosion of international law. This comes as Trump and Netanyahu are set to meet at the White House next week. And in the Democratic Republic of Congo, protests broke out in Kinshasa Tuesday as people denounced inaction from the international community to end the raging conflict in the eastern city of Goma, where M23 forces have consolidated power. The UN says over half a million people have been forced to flee their homes in January alone due to the escalating violence in the eastern DRC. Congo's foreign minister has called for targeted sanctions and an arms embargo against Rwanda over its backing of M23 soldiers and for Rwanda to withdraw its troops from the region. Hundreds of foreign military contractors crossed into Rwanda from Goma today as they surrendered to the UN after M23 fighters consolidated control of the eastern DRC's largest city. UN envoy for the DRC, Vivian van de Perre, addressed the Security Council Tuesday via video link from Goma, wearing a helmet and flak jacket as she pleaded with Rwanda and DRC to work toward a diplomatic solution.
We remind all parties of their obligation to uphold international humanitarian law and stress that attacks on United Nations peacekeepers may constitute war crimes. The degree of suffering that the population in Goma and its environment is enduring is truly unimaginable.
And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman in New York, joined by Democracy Now! Co-host Juan Gonzalez in Chicago. Hi, Juan.
Hi, Amy, and welcome to all of our listeners and viewers across the country and around the world.
Will low-income families be able to keep the heat on? Will seniors have access to another meal on wheels? Will Medicaid continue? Will low-income children get breakfasts or lunches at school? Will children be able to go to Head Start? These questions are still on the table, even after a federal judge in Washington, D.C. temporarily halted a radical plan that President Trump announced Tuesday to freeze trillions of dollars in federal grants and loans, even though the money's already been appropriated by Congress. A U.S. district judge said Tuesday she would decide by next week whether to make the injunction permanent. The ruling came after several nonprofits and attorneys general from 22 states filed lawsuits arguing the order would have a devastating impact on hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of recipients who rely on federal grants and loans for their operations. At the White House, Trump's new press secretary, Karoline Leavitt, defended his unprecedented actions.
It means no more funding for illegal DEI programs. It means no more funding for the Green New Scam that has cost American taxpayers tens of billions of dollars. It means no more funding for transgenderism and wokeness across our federal bureaucracy and agencies.
As Trump's federal spending freeze briefly took effect Tuesday, Medicaid reimbursement portals went down in all 50 states, cutting off compensation to hospitals and clinics that provide health care to children, low-income families, and people with disabilities. Washington Democratic Senator Patty Murray called Trump's executive order a brazen and illegal move. Maine Independent Senator Angus King said, quote, if this stands, then Congress may as well adjourn. Vermont Independent Senator Bernie Sanders declared of Trump he is not a king. Senate Democratic Leader Chuck Schumer said Trump's actions would likely impact universities, nonprofits, food assistance programs, hospitals, rural health centers, groups that assist disabled veterans, and much more.
This decision is lawless, it's destructive, it's dangerous, it's cruel, it's illegal, and it's unconstitutional. Donald Trump has done a lot of bad things in the last week, but nothing's worse than this.
House Democrats are having an emergency meeting today. Meanwhile, during an interview with Trump's Deputy Chief of Staff for Policy, Stephen Miller, CNN's Jake Tapper asked if the federal funding freeze would impact free school lunches. Miller responded with this point instead.
I want to really drill down on this, Jake, because it's so important. Mm-hmm. There's 2 million employees in the federal government. Overwhelmingly, the career federal service in this country is far left, left wing.
I don't know that to be a fact.
Well, I'll give you a great example. We looked at USAID as an example.
That's
98% of the workforce either donated to Kamala Harris or another left-wing candidate.
That, in fact, is not true. Sam Bagenstos is a law professor at the University of Michigan. He served as general counsel to the Office of Management and Budget under the Biden administration from 2021 to 2022 and is general counsel to the Health and Human Services Department until last December. He joins us now from Ann Arbor, Michigan. Well, why don't you start off, Professor Bagenstos, just responding to what has happened in the last 24 hours?
Well, look, it's just been complete chaos. On Monday night, the Office of Management and Budget issued this memo that purported to freeze a very, very, very broad swath of the federal financial assistance that state governments, private nonprofits, and individuals depend on across America. And you've talked about, you know, some of these programs, low-income heat assistance in the middle of winter, child care development block grants, Head Start, Medicaid, right? And we saw that across the country yesterday, Medicaid portals were shutting down because of this memo. Now, the administration has been backpedaling and trying to set itself up to, you know, to be in a position where they look better about this. So they've said over the last 24 hours, oh, no, 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 we didn't mean this, we didn't mean that. But we still have an incredible amount of uncertainty about whether people can get the benefits that they rely on and whether nonprofits that serve the community are going to be able to actually pay their bills because they're not going to get the money that they've been counting on. And this is money that Congress appropriated. Congress passed a law, the president signed it, and now Donald Trump says, look, I don't necessarily agree with the law, so I don't want to follow it. That is just completely illegal and with really devastating potential consequences for people.
But isn't this also Trump basically trying to test what the courts, the federal courts, will allow him to do and as he tries to grab more and more executive power?
Oh, I think absolutely right. I mean, this is an example. President Trump, his new nominee for the Office of Management and Budget, Russ Vought, who is the brains behind this kind of thing, even if he's not in office yet, what they want to do is challenge all of the limitations that have been placed on the president's power since the Nixon administration, since after Watergate. And in particular, they want to challenge the constitutionality of this law, the Impoundment Control Act, which is a law that just sets forth a basic constitutional principle, which is Congress, which represents the people, passes laws that decide how to spend the money. And, you know, if the president disagrees, the president can veto the law. But once a law is enacted, the president has to follow it. President Nixon tried to violate that principle. And so Congress, after Watergate, passed this law to say, no, 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 no. It's the people's house. It is Congress that has the power of the purse. And for years now, Trump and Russ Vought have been trying to challenge the Impoundment Control Act. They want to get a constitutional challenge to this law into the Supreme Court. They think with a very conservative court that has delivered Donald Trump some signature wins and that likes executive power when Republicans are president, they think they have a good chance of winning. I think they may be a bit overconfident, but, you know, I certainly understand the record that Donald Trump has had and Republican presidents have had with this court.
And could you specify a little bit more what the Impoundment Control Act, what are its provisions? Isn't there like a 45-day period during which Congress can act?
Yeah, I mean, so what the law says, again, is what it's trying to do is just enforce this basic constitutional principle that Congress is the one that decides how to spend our money. When Congress passes a law and the president signs it, a new president doesn't get to come in and say, I disagree with the policy, so I'm not going to follow it. So what the law does is a couple of things. One is it says there are only certain circumstances when a president can delay spending funds. And those circumstances very clearly and intentionally don't include disagreement with the policy reflected in a law passed by Congress, which is exactly what Trump and his OMB were trying to do with this memo. It said, however, if you think, President, that there is some, you know, improper decision made by Congress about how to spend money, we have a process for you, which is write out very clearly what are the specific expenditures that you think are improper, that, you know, shouldn't be followed as a matter of policy. Explain why, send that to Congress, and you can have 45 days while Congress is considering that. You can have 45 days of pausing the spending. Now, Trump didn't want to do that because that gives too much power to Congress. You know, what he wants to do is unilaterally decide just on his own, I disagree with the law, I don't want to follow it. But the process created in the Impoundment Control Act respects the ability of the president to come in and say, look, I want to make my case that that we should be spending our money differently, but it also ultimately respects the power of Congress elected by people around the country to decide how to spend our money and to pass our laws. And if that law is challenged successfully, then one more of the restraints on executive power that we have tried to build up to challenge this imperial presidency will fall away.
I want to ask you more about Russ' vote. They've put off the vote, but it looks like he will be approved as head of the OMB. And talk about the Project 2025, his role in that, and this latest article that talks about the metadata in the memo that was released by OMB showing that federal employees were written by people with ties to Project 2025.
Yeah, I mean, I think this is really fascinating because, of course, we heard throughout the campaign, right, the Trump campaign distancing itself from Project 2025. Oh, that wasn't us. That was a bunch of people operating on their own. Well, we know that Russ Vogt, who has been nominated to have a central position in the White House as head of the Office of Management and Budget, was absolutely at the center of drafting and producing Project 2025. We have seen over the past week plus that Trump has been in office for his second term, we have seen one after another of the Project 2025 proposals going into effect in his executive orders and executive actions from his administration. And the metadata point that you raise is just fascinating. When you look at the documents that have been produced, the executive orders and other executive statements that are supposedly documents produced by the Trump administration, and you see, you know, you go in and you see who actually wrote them, often it's people on the outside, very prominent conservatives on the outside, who were closely associated with and drafted portions of Project 2025. This is really Project 2025 trying to colonize the federal government, the federal executive branch. It's exactly the thing Trump denied all across the campaign, but it's exactly what's happening.
And what about this offer of the mass resignation of 2 million workers? I mean, it was astounding to hear Miller, now the deputy chief of staff, you know, known for his fierce anti-immigrant stance, when asked about what would happen, it was on this other point of kids not getting food and older people not. He switched gears and said, do you know how many of these workers supported Harris, and talked specifically about USAID? Whether what he said was true or not, that they 98% gave money to Harris or other, quote, left-wing candidates. The significance of what this means, urging the workforce to resign?
Yeah, I mean, look, in our government, to make it work, we rely on a professional career civil service. You know, that was a decision that we as a democracy made over 100 years ago to reform what was really a very corrupt system that was not governing effectively. And ever since the late 19th century, we can have criticisms about various aspects of civil service rules, but we have defended a career nonpartisan expert civil service that has been necessary to carry out the tasks of governance in an increasingly complex society. I have been both a career government official and a political appointee in two different administrations. And I can tell you the career civil servants, I don't know how they vote. You know, some of them vote Democrat, some of them vote Republican, some of them don't vote at all. But what they do is they provide real expertise in how to actually do the people's business. And you have seen over and over again the Trump administration, both the first time and now, trying to hollow out and really scare away the people who've worked incredibly hard, you know, to deliver health care to folks, to make sure that people have child care, to make sure that people get housing opportunities. These are people who are working really hard for ordinary folks in America, and they really shouldn't be treated this way. And I have to say, you know, the way that supposed buyout offer was drafted and sent around, I mean, it really, it's very sloppy. I don't think there was legal authority for it. I mean, there are certainly very substantial questions about that. And I think any government employee would be very, very, very much well advised to look really carefully at what they're agreeing to before they agree to something like that.
Sam Bagenstos, you are a law professor at University of Michigan. Before that, you served as general counsel to the Office of Management and Budget, and then general counsel to Health and Human Services. Do you want to share a final comment on the new person nominated to be head of that, Robert F. Kennedy Jr., before we play what his cousin has to say?
Look, I just think it's really dangerous to put someone like Robert F. Kennedy Jr. in charge of our health department. He has been an anti-vaxxer. He denies that, but, you know, there's a very clear record that he has stirred up fear and opposition to vaccination on the basis of falsehoods. And, you know, this is incredibly harmful to the public health. Look, you know, there are things that he talks about that I think a lot of us would agree with, you know, about trying to improve our food system, about aiming at prevention rather than treatment. You know, I think all that's great, but none of that outweighs the degree of disinformation and fear that he has cast out into the world that has really harmed the public health.
Sam Bagenstos, I want to thank you for being with us, law professor at the University of Michigan. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. We're going to stick with this issue for one more minute right now, actually six. Senate confirmation hearings open today for President Trump's pick to lead the Department of Health and Human Services, Robert F. Kennedy Jr., known for spreading public health conspiracy theories and disinformation, has claimed HIV may not cause AIDS, that COVID-19 was designed to spare Ashkenazi Jews and Chinese people, that chemicals in the U.S. water supply are leading more children to be gay and transgender. Ahead of RFK Jr.'s appearance before the Senate Finance Committee, his cousin, Carolyn Kennedy, the former U.S. ambassador to Japan and Australia, the daughter of President John F. Kennedy, called on senators to reject RFK Jr.'s confirmation. She read her entire letter to the senators aloud in a video she shared on social media. This is it.
Dear senators, throughout the past year, people have asked for my thoughts about my cousin, Robert F. Kennedy Jr., and his presidential campaign. I did not comment, not only because I was serving in a government position as United States Ambassador to Australia, but because I have never wanted to speak publicly about my family members and their challenges. We are a close generation of 28 cousins who have been through a lot together. We know how hard it's been, and we are always there for each other. But now that Bobby has been nominated by President Trump to be Secretary of Health and Human Services, a position that would put him in charge of the health of the American people, I feel an obligation to speak out. Overseeing the FDA, the NIH, the CDC, and Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, agencies that are charged with protecting the most vulnerable among us, is an enormous responsibility and one that Bobby is unqualified to fill. He lacks any relevant government, financial, management, or medical experience. His views on vaccines are dangerous and willfully misinformed. These facts alone should be disqualifying. But he has personal qualities related to this job, which for me pose even greater concern. I've known Bobby my whole life. We grew up together. It's no surprise that he keeps birds of prey as pets, because Bobby himself is a predator. He's always been charismatic, able to attract others through the strength of his personality, his willingness to take risks and break the rules. I watch his younger brothers and cousins follow him down the path of drug addiction. His basement, his garage, his dorm room were always the center of the action, where drugs were available, and he enjoyed showing off how he put baby chickens and mice in a blender to feed to his hawks. It was often a perverse scene of despair and violence. That was a long time ago, and people can change. Through his own strength and the many second chances he was given by people who felt sorry for the boy who lost his father, Bobby was able to pull himself out of illness and disease. I admire the discipline that took and the continuing commitment it requires. but siblings and cousins who Bobby encouraged down the path of substance abuse suffered addiction, illness, and death. While Bobby has gone on to misrepresent, lie, and cheat his way through life. Today, while he may encourage a younger generation to attend AA meetings, Bobby is addicted to attention and power. Bobby preys on the desperation of parents of sick children, vaccinating his own kids while building a following, hypocritically discouraging other parents from vaccinating theirs. Even before he fills this job, his constant denigration of our healthcare system and the conspiratorial half-truths he's told about vaccines, including in connection with Samoa's deadly 2019 outbreak of measles, have cost lives. And now we know that Bobby's crusade against vaccination has benefited him in other ways too. His ethics report makes clear that he will keep his financial stake in a lawsuit against an HPV vaccine. In other words, Bobby is willing to profit and enrich himself by denying access to a vaccine that can prevent almost all forms of cervical cancer and has already been safely administered to millions of boys and girls. During my time in Australia, I worked on the Quad Cancer Initiative, and I learned that cervical cancer is among the top three forms of cancer among women in a majority of countries. Tragically, every year, more than 200,000 children lose their mothers. They are orphaned due to a lack of vaccines and screening. Those are the real world consequences of Bobby's irresponsible beliefs. We are a close family, and none of that is easy to say. It also wasn't easy to remain silent last year when Bobby expropriated my father's image and distorted President Kennedy's legacy to advance his own failed presidential campaign, and then grovel to Donald Trump for a job. Bobby continues to grandstand off my father's assassination and that of his own father. It's incomprehensible to me that someone who is willing to exploit their own painful family tragedies for publicity would be put in charge of America's life and death situations. Unlike Bobby, I try not to speak for my father, but I am certain that he and my Uncle Bobby, who gave their lives in public service to our country, and my Uncle Teddy, who devoted his long Senate career to the cause of improving health care, would be disgusted. The American healthcare system, for all its flaws, is the envy of the world. Its doctors and nurses, researchers, scientists, and caregivers are the most dedicated people I know. Every day, they give their lives to heal and save others. They deserve a knowledgeable leader who is committed to evidence and excellence. They deserve a secretary committed to advancing cutting-edge medicine to save lives, not to rejecting the advances we have already made. They deserve a stable, moral, and ethical person at the helm of this crucial agency. They deserve better than Bobby Kennedy, and so do the rest of us. I urge the Senate to reject his nomination. Sincerely, Carolyn Kennedy.
That was Robert F. Kennedy Jr.'s cousin, Carolyn Kennedy, former U.S. ambassador to Japan and Australia, daughter of President John F. Kennedy. She sent that video and an accompanying letter to the Senate Finance Committee senators. RFK's confirmation to be Secretary of Health and Human Services begins today in the Senate. Next up, Mexican President Claudia Sheinbaum set to join other Latin American Caribbean heads of state for an emergency meeting to respond to Trump's mass deportations. We'll look at her first 100 days. Back in 20 seconds. Compañera Presidenta, Comrade President by Viviera Quintana. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. On Thursday, Mexican President Claudia Sheinbaum will join other leaders from Latin American and Caribbean countries in Tegucigalpa, Honduras, for an emergency meeting to respond to President Donald Trump's mass deportations and more. In one of Trump's first executive orders, he designated Mexican cartels terrorist organizations and followed up with the deployment of 1,500 active-duty troops to the U.S.-Mexico border. This was Mexican President Sheinbaum's response to a question from a reporter.
With cartels being considered terrorist organizations, what measures will the Mexican government take regarding future cases like these, President?
We are fighting these criminal groups, and what we want is collaboration and coordination. Unilateral decisions don't help. Collaboration does. So we're conducting a legal analysis of the implications for various organizations not linked to crime, which could face economic problems due to this decision. In any case, we aim to make a proposal to the United States, which is what we are working on, to collaborate together.
Meanwhile, President Sheinbaum mocked President Trump's renaming the Gulf of Mexico the Gulf of America during one of her recent daily news conferences as she stood in front of a large map from 1607 that labeled much of North America America Mexicana, or Mexican America.
The United Nations recognizes the name Gulf of Mexico, but next, why don't we call it Mexican America? It sounds nice, doesn't it? Since 1607, the Constitution of Apatzingán was Mexican America, so let's call it Mexican America. It sounds nice, doesn't it? Gulf of Mexico since 1607, and it is also internationally recognized.
This week, Google said it will rename the Gulf of Mexico Gulf of America in Google Maps for users in the U.S. For more on the first 100 days of Mexican President Claudia Sheinbaum, we're joined by Edwin Ackerman, sociology professor at Syracuse University, the author of Origins of the Mass Parties, Dispossession, and the Party Form in Mexico and Bolivia. Professor Ackerman, welcome back to Democracy Now! Why don't you respond to what we just laid out and lay out your response to the first 100 days of the first female president of Mexico.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me. Yeah, these past 100 days, I think, have been defined, on the one hand, by this constant tension and negotiations with the Trump administration that we can talk a bit more about. But I would also want to emphasize that, you know, on the domestic front within Mexico has also been a very sort of newsworthy 100 days in which there's been a series of constitutional reforms that have been passed, about a dozen of them, in this past 3 months. You have to remember, Claudia Sheinbaum comes in with a very strong hand. She has a two-thirds majority in both chambers and is following the sort of legacy and popularity of AMLO. She herself has maintained very high levels of popularity, and they have been able to push through several, again, important constitutional reforms that range from indigenous rights to housing rights to perhaps more polemically national security matters. So that's a very important part of this 100 days. Right? There's also been an unveiling of a very important six-year economic plan that would return to several elements of what used to be called import substitution industrialization, which was a sort of policy that reigned in many Latin American countries from the 50s to the 70s, roughly speaking, that saw significant levels of economic growth by pushing for national production to replace, in strategic ways, imports. That said, there's also been the continuation of violence related to the drug cartels, right? This is obviously a longstanding issue. It, you know, certainly hasn't gone away by any measure. There is some sense, some signs that there's some waning of homicide rates. But that said, there's significant concentrations of violence, significant pockets in the past 3 months, in particular in the state of Sinaloa. There's, you know, the city of Culiacán has been paralyzed by violence. So it's a continuing, very serious issue. And then finally, as I was mentioning, the relationship with with Trump, right, who has threatened tariffs over the question of trafficking of fentanyl or production of fentanyl in Mexico, or allegedly, allegedly production of fentanyl in Mexico, and question of how to deal with deportations, not only deportations of Mexican nationals back to Mexico, but even trickier, the deportation of non-Mexican nationals back to, to Mexican soil, which, again, adds another level of complication to the negotiations.
And Professor Ackerman, I wanted to ask you if you could hone in a little bit about the reforms that have occurred. You mentioned her popularity. She has an 80% positive rating among the Mexican public. Many of the people who didn't vote for her now support her. And some of the specific reforms, for instance, reducing the age for which women can qualify for a pension to 60 years of age versus 65 for men. What was her rationale for that?
Right. Yeah. So there's been a series of reforms, right, that I think partly explain the continuation of her popularity, as you were mentioning. The particular one that you mentioned that targets women, the rationale for that, as she says it explicitly in the morning conferences, is that women, for historical reasons, as she always points out, not that it has to be that way, but that in practice it has been that way for historical reasons, have taken a significant amount of work in the household that goes unpaid for, right? So that for her is a reason to lower the age to access that pension versus men.
And there have also been major changes in terms of the natural resources of Mexico and the social benefit. For instance, that the petroleum industry and other critical industries must pursue. Could you talk about that as well?
Right. I mean, so there's, yeah, significant changes to the energy sector that basically try and give the state a bigger share or stakeholder of the market to recenter the role of the state. And if you go down the list of reforms, this is basically the theme that you see. For example, on a slightly different topic, the question of housing. There's an important reform now in place that will turn an existing national credit fund that has existed for several decades that gives out credit to buy houses at affordable rates, to turn that fund into an actual agency that builds that constructs houses, right, with the aim of building a million houses during this 6-year period, right? So this is the state taking up the direct question of housing.
So, and of course, President Sheinbaum herself is a climate scientist, a former mayor of Mexico City. Mm-hmm. Can you talk about the meaning of Trump coming into office, how Sheinbaum has responded? You know, we saw when Trudeau came and had dinner with Mar-a-Lago, and now Trudeau is out.
Right.
Claudia Sheinbaum did not do anything like that,
right,
even when he threatened tariffs against
right.
her, but is accepting Mexican migrants back,
right,
being deported by plane.
Right, that's right. Right, so I think the strategy that the Mexican government has opted for is partly based on the previous experience of Trump's first term, right? You have to remember AMLO was in power when they overlap for a bit. So there's some record, some history there of how to deal with Trump. And it seems that the Mexican government has calculated that, let's say, diplomacy or sort of diplomatic strategic thinking over public confrontations get the results, right? There are several examples of this happening, again, during Trump's first term and its interaction with AMLO. There was tariffs also threatened back then. Several of these issues were placed on the table and eventually neutralized. And I think Sheinbaum has been able to, up to this point, do so. I think this has to do with a couple of things. One is that if we step back from the Trump years, it's not an exaggeration to say that from the point of view of Mexico, on many of these issues, there's no significant difference in practice between a Democratic administration and a Republican administration. If you think about things like the building of the wall, it began during a Democratic administration, right? 94 during Clinton, continued through the Obama period. That is, the wall itself is not, you know, specific to Trump. Mass deportations, as I'm sure your audience is well aware of, you know, Obama and Biden, for that matter, have significant numbers of deportations that even overcome Trump's first term. And even the pressure for Mexico to secure its southern border against Central American migrants also precedes Trump. So there's a longstanding record of negotiation or conversation, obviously very difficult and under asymmetrical conditions. Right? Now, the second thing to say is that I think the Mexican administration is betting on the tariff threats being a bluff, right? Not only because those threats already had existed in the past and they ended up going nowhere, but because there's, let's say, structural reasons for why, you know, imposing the U.S. imposing tariffs on Mexico would be, you know, shooting itself on the leg. Not only would it have the effect of raising prices for U.S. consumers, which we know, you know, can have significant political consequences, but also in a broader sense, tariffs and tariff threats respond to a stage of global capitalism in which we're not anymore. Trump is operating from the point of view that you can sort of prop up, in a sense, national capitalists in an age of globalized capital in which it's unclear, for example, if you're placing tariffs on Mexican imports, to what degree are those imports being produced by Mexican capital as opposed to U.S. capital or international capital. So that sets some limits on tariffs. Yeah.
Professor Ackerman, I want to follow up on this tariff issue because, yeah, clearly, since Mexico is the largest trading partner of the United States right now, it would be counterproductive in terms of Mexico. But some of the smaller Latin American states, that's, I mean, true, the threats of tariffs against Colombia or against Panama, because Trump claims he wants to retake Panama. A lot of people are not aware that all of these, even the threats by Trump, are violations of the Organization of American States Charter, which mm-hmm. the United States helped found. Mm-hmm. Article 20 says no state mm-hmm. may use or encourage the use of coercive measures of an economic or political character in order to force the sovereign will of another state and obtain from it advantages of any kind. Mm-hmm. Do you sense that this Trump policy is going to end up uniting Latin America more in opposition to the United States?
I think so. And there are some inklings that that's already happening, right? There's ongoing conversations, the possibility of meetings, of renewing certain sort of efforts at collaboration that already existed in some institutional way, particularly formed in the sort of first wave of what's referred to as the Pink Tide, you know, at the beginning of the 2000s, when a series of progressive governments take office throughout the southern continent, right? Some of those efforts that were put in place again in the early 2000s were later abandoned or put to the wayside as some of these countries elected right-wing formations, but we can, you know, see again a renewed pink tide, if you will, that partly is interested in this also even before Trump taking office. Partly is interested in creating stronger links, both at the political level in terms of coordinating responses, and at the economic level in terms of integrating to some degree the economies. And you hear a lot of buzz about this happening in the past 3 months. Yes.
I want to thank you so much for being with us, Edwin Ackerman, sociology professor at Syracuse University. And this update, Honduras President Xiomara Castro says she's canceled Thursday's meeting of the Community of Latin American and Caribbean States, CELAC, citing lack of consensus. Next up, we look at DeepSeek, back in 20 seconds. In these times of contention, in this- by Buzzcocks. This is Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. We end today's show looking at how the Chinese startup DeepSeek, which uses a free open-source artificial intelligence model, has upended Silicon Valley. Its new low-cost AI tool, R1, has surged to the top of Apple's App Store, overtaking OpenAI's ChatGPT. Meanwhile, artificial intelligence giant NVIDIA lost almost $600 billion in value Tuesday, the biggest single-day loss for a public company. In December, DeepSeek said its model only took 2 months and less than $6 million to build, despite U.S. restrictions on chip exports to China, a tiny fraction of the cost that U.S. tech giants have spent on AI. Just last week, President Trump announced Stargate, a $500 billion project to boost AI infrastructure in the U.S., and he promised it would create new jobs. For more, we're joined from Los Altos, California, by Ramesh Srinivasan, professor of information studies at UCLA, host of the podcast Utopias, author of Beyond the Valley, How Innovators Around the World Are Overcoming Inequality and Creating the Technologies of Tomorrow. In this last few minutes we have, Professor Srinivasan, can you talk about the significance of DeepSeek?
Yes, I mean, it's very, very profound. I mean, basically for $6 million, they were able to develop a large language model, which is basically the brains for future AI systems of all kinds, for $6 million, compared to hundreds of billions of dollars that were allocated for initiatives like the Stargate project. Now, this is not apples to apples. So the $6 million is not totally equivalent to the $500 billion and the investments tied to that. But the key issue is this: DeepSeek was able to train and refine its models using open source kinds of content, getting input from communities of developers all around the world. And this is very insightful. It's an example of something that we've always known in tech, that innovation is not just creating the latest iPhone 15 versus 16, or just pouring tons of money into energy and other expenses in the sort of, you know, resource unconscious way, but it's actually being resourceful. And the open source community is why DeepSeek was able to basically perform very close to the level, if not stronger, than ChatGPT's latest, or at least previous to latest versions, for a fraction of the cost. And this is a key, key breakthrough. And this is why we're seeing so much volatility in Silicon Valley as we speak.
And why is this being seen as a threat rather than as enormous progress in terms of development of artificial intelligence?
Right. It's very much a threat because many Silicon Valley models are based on proprietary sorts of platforms or proprietary data. They are gathering data from all of us to inform their AI systems, which are going to be used primarily for their benefits. Never mind that there are various fairly unclear and possibly empty promises about jobs that these AI infrastructures like Stargate will create. So this is just a remarkable example of one thing that's always been powerful about the internet and the web, which is people can support one another and build on one another's work. And that's what DeepSeek has actually shown us. And they validated that in various reports, and a number of researchers I've looked at have validated their findings. But the Silicon Valley model, which has in its past and even to this day sometimes uses open source input, has primarily been gated communities, you know, walled gardens, algorithmic, you know, extremist content, as we've talked about many times before.
Yeah, we have less than a minute, but I wanted to ask you, on Tuesday, sure, OpenAI announced a new product called ChatGPT Gov, built exclusively for the United States government. Could you talk about that briefly?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, look, there's more and more of a very direct and explicit marriage that we're seeing between the Trump administration and tech oligarchs. I mean, we saw it at the inauguration. We're seeing it in this initial week and weeks of campaign promises. So it's really no surprise that big tech is kind of colliding with the state, because it's all about the concentration of power. But I want to remind everybody that even back in the Obama era, Google was the biggest lobbyist during the Obama administration. So we need to be vigilant and ensure that AI systems and technologies of all kinds support laborers, citizens, and people around the planet. And that's what's woefully missing in most discussions of DeepSeek, OpenAI, and big tech in general.
And finally, in 10 seconds, how does this relate to TikTok, if it does in any way, with the decision coming down and whether it'll be banned?
Very important question.
These are all data grabs, right? So part of Musk's ownership of Twitter/X is the data that can be grabbed to form his own AI initiatives, which are trying to compete with OpenAI. It's going to be a very similar issue when it comes to TikTok. The acquisition of TikTok is an acquisition of a largesse of data, at least American data. America has the largest number of TikTok users in the world. So that data can all be mined to reconstruct these types of chatbots, which again are the brains of different types of consumer-facing AI systems.
Ramesh Srinivasan of UCLA. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Thanks for joining us.
California, that fragrance, that payments, take places. California, I don't want to be the one that's left behind. I love the way you lie. Trying to get my money back straight this time. The hills is gone.
Yeah, I don't know where I went wrong with you. Hey, I was driving around in Cali.
I feel like as long as they gather my names, man, all I can wish is the mask that I wear and the faces below it is looking the same. Like,
oh, you've been in this fight, I can see it in your eyes. Like, oh, I made up my mind, I don't wanna waste no time.
Money making, while we're breaking, it's amazing, California.